everyone, and welcome to the Bone Club. We had a great time in Afs at the last episode in Baltimore, though it was really freezing the entire episode. And we have Stephanie and our guest, Catherine, were both at the meeting there. I believe, Catherine, you were there since it was in your home place. And it's just too cold for anything. But we had a wonderful conversation about artificial intelligence and ethics. And so we have a wonderful episode today on vicarious trauma. So you have with us today, you have myself, Ashley, we have Stephanie and Jenna, and our guest, Catherine Pope, or Kat, who is a doctoral student at the University of Maryland, who is also a diplomat with the American Board of Medical Legal Death Investigators, a fellow in the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, has worked in medical examiner's offices and RTI International, SNA International, as well as serves on the Vicarious Trauma Committee with AAFS. So just to be a little lighthearted here, hello. Everybody want to say hello?
Hey, everyone. It's good to see y'all again. Well, hear you. Maybe you hear us. You know. Welcome back.
It's good to be back. I missed last week, so I'm so excited to be here.
So, Kat, what got you interested in anthropology? Most of our listeners are undergraduate students interested in forensic anthropology. What got you interested into this field? You're muted.
I've got a cold and I'm coughing a lot. Is that better?
You're good.
Awesome. Yeah, I knew, I mean, probably since middle school that I really wanted to do something abnormal. Both of my parents are first responders, and I used to go with my dad down to the firehouse and hang out for the day. And I remember one day we went on a call and we ended up at the hospital. I'm just hanging out in the ER and this guy gets wheeled in and he had been researching how to commit suicide. I mean, he had a stack like 3 feet tall of papers. This is back when you had to print stuff. And he had spent all this time and effort like trying to figure out how to kill himself, and he didn't succeed still. You know, he had made it to the hospital. Somebody called 911 and they were helping him out. And I was like, wow, it's so crazy. You know, like all that effort, what he could have done, you know, he could have cured cancer or like, and it just got my wheels kind of going on the abnormal thing. And I just, from that time forward, I was really interested in psychology, forensic investigation, and I kind of snowballed into reading, you know, the Kathy Reichs books that were out back in the day and watching CSI. I'm definitely a kid of the 90s, so that was my jam. But when I went to college, one of the big forensic anthropologists in the world, Laura Fulgenetti, was teaching a special course. She had gone to the tiny little college I went to, and she would come up every 2 years and teach forensic anthropology. So I just, it was like good luck. It was kismet that I got to take an osteology class and forensic, you know, methods, and just clicked. It was like everything made sense about bones, you know, like it's just to me so obvious that that's what you do, you know, like that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So I went and got my master's degree. I knew I didn't want to be a professor. I've never wanted to teach. I love talking to folks. I love talking to students, but it's not my jam. So I knew I wanted to go right into death investigation. And very fortunately, every office I've worked at has let me use my forensic anthro background to assist in investigation of death. So not just skeletons in the woods, but we also got to use my experience to help with trauma analysis, positive scientific identification of tentatively identified, you know, decomps or fire victims, mass fatalities. So I really got to use, you know, my practice at the ground level, which was really, really cool. And then I kind of snowballed into a career for the last 5 years with NAMIS. So I assist with missing and unidentified persons cases, which I did until about 6 months ago. So I feel really honored and lucky because I think there are not a lot of jobs out there. But for people who are listening who are really passionate about human osteology, anatomy, forensic investigation, there are places that you can use your experience and background for sure. You don't have to go, there's not one right way to get into this field. There are lots of really cool places we can use our skills.
Yeah, I find that to be rather true. There are multiple avenues. There's not one straight path that everybody must go down, which is often recommended, I find. And it's strange. I don't understand the strangeness of it.
I also find that, like, if you everyone goes on that same path, then everyone's learned exactly the same thing, and then the field stagnates. And so, like, if you have people that come from all different backgrounds into this field, they might bring something like from psychology, like what we're going to talk about today, that maybe we never really thought of because, we only took our anthropology classes, or we only took, whatever that we can use more than just anthropology to do anthropology.
And I love what you said about that when you took your osteo course and the bones just clicked with you, because that's what happened with me. Like, I was in a different field, but bones always just like I don't know, it's kind of crazy to say, but they like spoke to me. It just makes sense. The bones just make sense. And I feel you on that one.
Isn't there a book labeled that or something? Like Bones Talk or something? I think so.
Oh,
Maybe
probably, yeah.
not.
Your next novel?
Oh, no.
We'll
No one needs to read my books.
just hear your voice instead.
Well, I wish it'd scream sometimes more than just talk.
Just like write down your name. That'd be cool.
Name, when you last were alive, what happened to you?
Hey, sometimes, I mean, I don't know how much y'all believe in like supernatural things, but sometimes at work, I definitely there's something going on because every once in a while, like not necessarily that they'll write their name down because how lucky we would be if that happened, but like certain things will happen that like something catches your eye that like maybe you would have missed otherwise or whatever, that you're like, why was I getting stuck on this one thing? And that ends up being the thing that IDs the person, and you're like, they were pulling something on the other side, trying to be like, look at this. Or at least that's what I think.
It's so cool.
Well, Kat, you mentioned something about your childhood, and I think it does bring it lead into today's topic, which is going in as a child into the ER, seeing what you saw, and that has to leave some sort of mark, whether for good or for bad. And with that, we is that what we would call vicarious trauma? And if not, what is that?
Yeah, I think
What, yeah.
really is like more of a culmination, like a buildup of secondary trauma. So if you experience, I think a lot of the times it's thought of with first responders, so police officers, therapists, people who witness trauma daily, in this process of their jobs, people that, forensic practitioners that look at child pornography. These people are thought of to have this buildup of awful things happening to them, right? So primary trauma is that when you see something firsthand, like if you see somebody get hit by a car or if you get hit by a car. And that secondary trauma is when you hear about it or if you witness it, or, these are kind of fluid terms, right? But the vicarious trauma is the buildup of that stuff. So And my husband even talks about, he calls it tertiary trauma, because I'll have a really bad case and I'll tell him about it. So then he's hearing about it like third hand. But really, I mean, the bottom line is that what we're finding and what researchers are finding is hearing about this stuff is almost as bad as seeing it or experiencing it yourself. And can leave just as permanent of a mark on you, if you don't get the opportunity to resolve that sort of trauma. So, I think when I was a young person, like we talked about stuff, bad stuff at the dinner table all the time, because my dad was a paramedic, and my mom was a ER nurse. So that was just normal. And then my husband, he's a teacher. My husband's mom, is a teacher. Like, they didn't talk about that stuff at the dinner table. So I didn't realize that it was traumatizing for them to hear that stuff until you're like, oh, yeah, I guess this isn't normal dinner talk. But so those terms too can be used differently with different people. Certain people can experience more vicarious trauma than other people if they're not used to that sort of thing. And I think that's what really what I hope to kind of clear the way with folks that are coming into this field is students aren't really prepared for this sort of thing, and I'm an older person, so back in the day it was like we definitely didn't get training in how to talk to families or how to handle, handle, yes, physically, right, handle human remains, but like going home at the end of the day and smelling like decomp, or thinking about like macerating a body is, can be kind of a can we curse on this podcast?
Yeah.
Okay. It's kind of a mind fuck, right? Like
Yeah.
you're playing around in somebody's bits and innards, and it's really so preparing people for that sort of thing, and that cumulative effect of dealing with that sort of thing is really what I hope, just simply talking about it will kind of navigate and advocate for people, and get more familiar with them.
Well, and I don't know if it is what it is. But I know this with some of the people that I've worked with, both, macerating remains, dissecting remains, working on cases, things like that. It's, you work on the case, you work with the remains, and just stoic or even jovial, because it's just that there's something just disconnect. But this minor, not even relate, like a glass breaking or something just otherworldly, just at completely outside, and that brings you to tears. And it's just this complete disconnect of one from the other. And I've Jenna can attest to this, because I've told her this as a student. You can always tell who's going to make it in this field by the ones who can survive working on their first, well, to be crass, their first kid. If you can't do that, you're not going to survive this field, I don't think. But the question then becomes, how do we process that? How do we deal with that and cope with dealing with those situations frequently?
Yeah, and I always try to remind people too, it's, we are built to, we're as scientists, so we're prepared to compartmentalize that, right? Set everybody up in human anatomical position and to do your analysis and write your report, and you go through these very methodical processes, and that's fine. But like you said, then it's like somebody in your office is an asshole, or like the water cooler's empty. It's those routine mundane things that happen where that really throws you for a loop. And I think to answer your question, it's building those resiliencies within your daily practice. So like making sure that you're actually recognizing that you're feeling a little like I'm a little on edge. I just had to put together a kid, or this is my third homicide of the week. I'm exhausted. It, just being able to say that, name it, and then going forward, recognizing with your colleagues that you work with, when you see something kind of abnormal. So that's what happened with me. I mean, I was fine. I was killing it in work, but then like these little things would start to drive me crazy. And I'm a very easygoing person, but like I worked an entire weekend, and I also handled acute cases that were not skeletonized. So I'm awake for 40 hours straight. And I took my cell phone would not stop ringing. And I slammed it on the ground. I was trying to take a dog walk and just like chill. And it would not shut up. So I slammed it on the concrete and broke it. And that's not something that's normal for me, right? But instead, my manager wrote me up and I got in trouble. But instead of being like, oh my gosh, you're a good person, you don't break state equipment, are you okay? Let's get you some help, let's get you some coverage. She wrote me up and I got in trouble. So that just kind of that compounded the trauma and made me think, oh, I'm wrong for feeling upset. And then just made it worse. So what really needs to happen in our field is that appreciation that this is tough, right? But then also on top of the tough is the normal everyday stuff. And let's just give each other a break and recognize and start to build that resiliency.
I would
When it
say,
comes to, sorry.
go ahead, Jenna. You can go
When
first.
it comes to vicarious trauma, everybody is going to be different. For some people, it might kind of creep up on you slowly. And for other people, you might just kind of get smacked by it right in the face and you're just on your butt. For those who find that it creeps up on them, what are some of those like early warning signs that you might be starting to experience the vicarious trauma, or you're starting to enter the zone of PTSD, or things like that? I mean, everyone will be different, but are there some key warning signs that you would advise people to be on the lookout for?
Yeah, there's a great slide I can send to you guys if you want to post it with the podcast. But PTSD diagnoses have to occur after the event, and that the symptoms that you meet, I think there are like eight criteria that you have to meet, and it has to interrupt your life, and it has to go on for a certain amount of time. I believe it's a month or 6 months. So those criteria are actually really great check engine lights for people to recognize, oh, something's going on. Like this is obviously starting to interrupt my life. It's lasting a long time. Some of those things are like being hypervigilant. So that was me. Again, I'm a very easygoing person. One day my husband drove off and my kids like started chasing after him in the car. And I was like, oh my God, like you're gonna fall under the wheels and get crushed. And like, that's not gonna happen. It doesn't happen, Or like they're playing in the backyard and I see a tree limb just fall on them. Or I had a drowning of an 8-year-old and I started literally flashing through all the little kids that I knew in my neighborhood, the face of on the decedent. So that's one of the symptoms that qualifies you for PTSD diagnosis. Doing things that you don't necessarily want to, like drinking too much, doom scrolling, buying too many things. Those things by themselves, these eight criteria by themselves don't necessarily mean that yes, you may be having a little bit of disordered thinking, you may be experiencing some vicarious trauma, but when you start to combine them together and they last for a long time, that's when you're in danger of having that PTSD. And it requires, like a little bit more of an intervention at that point. And I was definitely diagnosed with PTSD.
I would say this is kind of where, like, for me, my like grad school research was all about like cognitive thinking and bias and other things like that. How do you think, I guess, that plays into vicarious trauma? Because for me, like, my understanding at least is like if the field keeps progressing in the way that some people want us to, of we're objective, we can compartmentalize, we are separate from our cases, we are not, we're just doing the science, we're not a part of the science. I think that's only going to make the vicarious trauma worse because you're ignoring the impact you have on the science and the science has on you. But I just kind of wanted your opinion on how you think like objectivity or like people pretending to be objective, it has on vicarious
Pretending,
trauma.
I love that. I'm all for objectivity and providing unbiased analysis. I mean, I think there have been many situations where people have overstepped and over-described, trauma or taken our methods a little too far and said things that can't possibly be true. Like race is a social construct. We can't, we cannot be doing what we were back in like the 70s and 80s. And I see lots of examples of that, when I was working in Namus with reviewing old historical cases. There has been a lot of issues with that in our field. However, I don't think, I mean, this is my professional opinion, I don't think we can completely divorce ourselves from the casework that we're doing. I mean, there has been suggestions that we could like not know anything about the case and only look at, the decedent and the remains. And that's just not possible. We need the cultural artifacts that are found with the remains. We need to know like the location. We have to find a happy medium for that. And I think that's definitely true with our experience within, this field and being able to be good anthropologists, right? Good anthropologists look at the entire picture. We have to be a part of the medical legal system. We have to be a part of the criminal justice system, but we are also advocates for, humanitarian efforts too. So, and I think that my experience working in the medical examiner's office has just been like that voice that's kind of different, and I feel very honored that most of the places that I've worked has listened to me as that different voice. And I think many, people who are listening to this that are getting ready maybe to go into medical examiner's offices, you probably will work by yourself unless you work with DPAA, or in New York City or like Harris County. Like there are very few offices that have more than one forensic anthropologist on staff. So part of our, I think part of our goal when we're in there is to be a representative, showing this kind of like full approach, right? Being a good cultural advocate, being, but also a good scientific advocate. And that's what I've found. I think it can be really hard, like to work alone too. I mean, being the sole practitioner, like you don't really have anybody to rely on. So I'm a member of SOFA, which is a Society of Forensic Anthropologists. So we like bounce ideas. We can peer support or peer review each other's reports. So send each other pictures and like, hey, I've never seen this trauma before. Will you take a look at it? So that's a really good way to kind of build resiliency too, is, like things like addiction and like PTSD, they make you feel very alone. I mean, I was so embarrassed that like my victims were supposed to be the victims, not me. Like I was, I signed up for this. I was supposed to be, muscle up, buttercup, right? But when I started talking about it out loud and saying like, oh, I'm struggling, I'm having a hard time, so many people were like, oh my gosh, me too. So that's another way to kind of to get help, and it doesn't make you biased at all. Like if you have to ask for assistance, that doesn't make you a bad person. It makes you a human that wants to learn more things, right? And I think for so long too, forensic anthropologists, like they were leaned on by professionals, law enforcement, like to have the right answer, like to always guess the race, of the person, or like always have to know if it's male or female, or like, was he a tennis player, out on the scene. It's like, I can't get comfortable with saying, you have to get comfortable saying, like, I'm not going to tell you that right now. I need to take these remains back to the lab. I need to do further analysis. And I also may not be able to tell you, their population affinity. I may not be able to say that. And that's something that many folks in the back of the day did not really feel comfortable doing. So that's definitely the future of our field too. And with that comes a more confidence and people being able to say, like, I'm struggling mentally, or I'm, whatever.
Being okay with that gray area. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think as a field where we are starting to see, you can start to see it with young people coming up, not necessarily within the field, but within law enforcement, young law enforcement officers that are willing to accept more of a gray answer than, say, 15 years ago or more, where they wanted black and white. And that, I think,
Or Asian.
is going to change. Or
That
Asian.
was a joke. Eat,
Yes.
eat.
One thing though that does pop into my head, and it's because I deal with this on a personal level, is when you struggle with a and struggle is not necessarily the right word, but when you deal with an underlying mental health condition, for me it's bipolar disorder and borderline personality disorder. Does and what you have seen, does interactions within the field, particularly within casework, exacerbate, or does is there a way to separate the two? Sort of just, well, these are in this category, and this is PTSD and secondary trauma over here, or is it just, well, this is just one big ugly mess, and you need to go see the Grippy Socks Distribution Center.
I don't have an answer to that. I mean, I think, in my experience, I am my work, you know, like it's such a huge part of my life that I think that was not necessarily the problem, but like what led me down the road of kind of burning out so hard, was that I did, like I described myself as a forensic anthropologist first, you know, before being a mom or being a spouse. So I think, you know, our mental health conditions are a part of us. They're who we are. Just like our jobs are a part of us and they are our experiences. And I don't think they're necessarily a problem, you know, I think they lead us to want to advocate more for our clients, for our victims. You know, if we see them, if we see ourselves, and I don't necessarily believe in empathy because we can never know really truly what people are feeling like. But if we understand that we are just a part of our community, you know, and the people, then we can understand that everybody deserves their name, right? And that's why we try so hard, and we care so much about the people that we work on because we believe that they deserve to have their identities back. At least
I would
that's what I
agree.
believe.
Yeah, I think in some ways the things that, at least in my case, have happened to me, made me more equipped for the job. And in some ways they made it harder to process things when they got hard. But I think a lot of people would ask me, like, how do you do that? Like, how do you go in there to people's homes when it's a fire scene and collect dead bodies? And for me, I know that it's something that I'm good at, and I lost my brother a year before entering the program. But I lost my brother to cancer, so I got answers. And losing him was really hard, and in some ways it makes it harder to handle things in any given situation, but it also makes me work harder for the victims' families, I think. I can compartmentalize how awful a scene is or what I'm looking at, because I know how important it is for closure when you've lost someone.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know where, like, I don't know why forensic scientists are supposed to be these like robots. You know, I guess I appreciate that we need to be good scientists, right? And follow the scientific method and do things, but we can't forget who we are when we do this, because why would we do it then if we were, you know?
No, I totally agree. I mean, that was like at work all the time, like anytime someone's having a bad day or anytime like a case is getting frustrating, or like even this morning where I'm like, it's my day off and I'm still working a little bit because I think we all do. It's like trying to be like, okay, yes, I'm frustrated. Yes, I have all of these emotions, but also, why am I doing this? And it's like, if that why goes away or the why is not enough, then that's when you know you do need to leave the field or whatever. And it's not because you couldn't handle it or whatever, but it just, it's best for you. But it's like that why really matters. And I think that's why, like, this at the beginning of the podcast, you know, we asked, like, why did you get into the field? Because at the end of the day, that's why we do anything. Like, the reason we found an interest in bones or found an interest in forensics as a whole really guides us and helps ground us when everything else is kind of going crazy.
I wonder if that robotic archetype is sort of a Hollywood creation. And not necessarily just forensics, but just scientists in general. You think of movies and TV shows, particularly in the early 2000s and before, and scientists, with rare exceptions, were always the nerdy type, robotic nerdy type. A lot of Sheldons from Big Bang Theory. We're all supposed to be Sheldons, and I wonder if that has crept into the field and the belief.
Yeah, that's funny.
I also think that more often than not, kind of going back to what I was saying before, that like having people that have lots of different experiences helps combat that a little bit, because then every time you show up to a scene or to a courthouse or even to a family's like to talk to them, when you're not that stereotype necessarily, or even if you are, but like being able to show yourself in that situation helps the public view of what our science is. And so I know a couple episodes ago we talked a lot about like science communication, and I think a lot of that kind of plays into, okay, well, if we can be good advocates for each other within the field, we can also be good advocates for, you know, the people that we're trying to identify and for their families. And to be able to just like be yourself in all of those situations helps really alleviate some of that, like, oh, I need to be perfect, or I have to have the right answer, or I have to, you know, X, Y, Z. And when you can be yourself, then you can admit to yourself when you're having those types of traumas.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think coming into things, like Ashley had asked if like pre-existing conditions exacerbate the problem. I think it also is a superpower in a certain way. You've been coping with things that other people haven't had to your entire life. So you've got extra building blocks for how to survive in challenging environments. And I think that's like a part of you that actually, if you feel the same, because obviously I'm not inside your head, but I think that those are things that could potentially make you even better at surviving a field like that.
I would say, Kat, do you have any, I guess, like kind of along those same lines, like coping mechanisms or things that you think have worked for you in the past for not only being able to recognize what you're feeling, but how to like combat those issues?
Yeah, absolutely. When I first started, like I've already talked about connections, so reaching out and like being around people that are very familiar to you and your experience, right? So like I would try to rely on my husband about work related stuff, but he's not set up for that, you know, like he's a teacher, bless his little heart. So like finding people like a peer support team of other forensic anthropologists or like a group of people that do the same kind of job is really important to rely on. So that connection was a big part of my building of, rebuilding my resiliency. I also did a lot of journaling in the beginning, so just like getting all that stuff out of my head. I call it like mindful decontamination, like purging the shit and the funk out of your brain, because again, I thought like I was keeping it all up inside my head because, like, oh, for God's sakes, how dare I have bad feelings or like feeling sad or like that's, I'm so bad. And then I'm blaming and shaming, and it's just getting worse and worse. So, writing things down, not just the bad stuff, right? So, like, setting a timer for every day or sometimes a couple times a day and actually just writing. And then you start to rely on that time. So, you're not necessarily like, twirling up in worry and anxiety, you're like, okay, wait, I have this time like a little bit later today. So that was really helpful for me also, starting to rely on connecting with people, writing things down. When I was really having a hard time, I got really serious about like my nutrition, drinking a ton of water, like I stopped drinking alcohol. I really focused on my sleep, so making sure that I was getting good sleep, which is harder to do when you're working like an on-call job, but I certainly like there are ways kind of around it. And then also like setting goals for myself. So something I could look forward to that had nothing to do with dead people. And that could be anything for anybody, right? Like if you like to knit or make sourdough starters and bread or like, jujitsu, like it doesn't have to necessarily be like run a marathon because I don't run unless somebody's chasing me. But like for some people, that's what they dig, right? I did a lot of yoga in the beginning, which was cool because like it was something that I was terrible at and then I got really good at it. So it was like a goal I could see myself progressing towards. It didn't have anything to do with dead people. So those are some really important things that I recommend. Really bringing it back to basics, like calm, sleeping, eating, writing, purging, and setting goals.
I was actually ordered to pick up hobbies that were not related to dead people.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So I picked up photography and archery and astronomy, and that's that's one thing I tell all of my students, all grad students that come in. That's one thing I tell them is you have to have a hobby that is not related to this field because you will burn out faster than you can imagine.
Yeah, that was definitely another thing when I was diagnosed with PTSD. My doctor was like, "Well, what else do you do?" And I'm like, "What do you mean? What else do I do? Like,
This
this
is
is it." And then I was like, "Oh, this is not healthy."
But I think a lot of times, those like back to basics that you were talking about, people think are so simple that they're like, "Well, of course I need a work-life balance. Of course I need friends. Of course." And but then like in your actual day-to-day practice, you're like, do I actually have those things? I say I do because you're like, yeah, it's fine. Like everything's cool. And then you're like, actually, I've worked 70 hours this week and I've slept maybe 20 and I haven't eaten food in 2 days. What is going on? But like,
And honestly, I tell people, I think work-life balance for us is bullshit. I mean, it's not going to happen. So the more you try to strive for that balance, the more you're going to stress yourself out. So recognizing that, like, that shit is not gonna, that ship has sailed, that's not going to happen. And then finding somewhere else. So balance for us isn't 50-50. It's just not going to happen. And so, like, really relying on that time that you do have free, taking your day off, right? So you had to work today, right? So what else special are you going to do for yourself because you did have to, like, take a couple hours to actually work? Or like maybe you can take another day off. And finding that time. Like, because I used to work on call all the time. I was like, okay, well, I'm not going to rely on this PTO that I've or the time that I've gotten. My doorbell's ringing. I don't know if you can hear that. But so then like not relying on that money that I've made extra and actually saving that for me for something special, or like saving the time that I've gathered from working so much and like actually taking that off, not just letting it sit in my queue, and never take that day off, like actually take the day off and be off.
Would you say that like a key is kind of creating boundaries wherever you can squeeze them? Because boundaries don't come.
100%. Saying no, that was my 2025 New Year's resolution.
And that's so hard for, I think, people in our field because you're so used to trying to hustle just to get a foot in the door that saying no feels so painful.
Yep.
And I think that's one thing that's even harder for those getting started, particularly those in master's and really in PhD work, because you've got to get your papers out as fast as you possibly can. You've got to get stuff, got to get to conferences and present at conferences all you can. Got to get the teaching. You got to get do the case. You just this whole massive list of everything you've got to do, because you're competing. It just even though you're not, it feels like your every day is a competition. If not with the person two universities over, with the person on the next lab bench. And that becomes a real issue.
When I think a lot of that, like, I feel most fields probably have that competition. I don't want to say that's just an anthropology thing, but I think
No.
being willing to like talk with your cohort and willing, because like competing is not necessarily a bad thing. It might make you work harder. It might make you learn something that you would have maybe not otherwise have, but when you notice yourself like only worrying about the competing or only worrying about like, okay, well, this person did this, so I have to do XYZ, and like that making those boundaries not where they need to be. Where I really liked what Kat had said about like your balance isn't necessarily 50-50. You have to find the balance for you. And so it's like, well, if I notice that like my mental health is dodoing okay, having 70% work and 30% personal life, then that's my balance and that's okay. Other people's balance might be 80 and 20. And so they probably will get more done than me. But that doesn't mean I need to change my balance to be theirs, because that's when you're not going to be able to like be yourself and you're not going to do good work or do good work, like
Stuff.
anything, like work and life. You're not going to be the best you need to be. I know I had I've well, I'm gonna age myself a little bit too. So on Facebook, that someone had wrote, essentially it was like, everyone has, their plate of stuff they can handle, and some people's plates are made of steel and some people's plates are made of paper, but that doesn't mean you should put something that a steel plate can handle on your paper plate. And that really like made me like stop and be like, and just because I'm a paper plate doesn't mean that it's worse, because there's certain things that paper plates can do that steel cannot do. And so like having to find the good in those differences.
Well, I think this has been a fantastic conversation, is one I th that our field, and not only Forensic Anthropology, but all of forensic science and anybody within the medical legal death investigation sphere, and is going to be tackling for the next little while, on how to properly address this and right the ship. But with that, I do want to thank Kat for coming on our podcast today. I think it was a fantastic conversation. I want to thank you so much.
Well, thanks for
If
having
you,
me.
if any of our guests have any questions for you, can they send you an email or anything like that through us to
Absolutely.
you, or is that okay?
Yeah, and I'll send you guys the landing page for the American Academy of Forensic Sciences has a vicarious trauma committee. So we're going to be putting a lot of stuff on our landing page there. We're hoping to have a workshop out like mid-year. So, maybe August-ish, some sort of trauma workshop. the theme of next year's conference is actually back to basics. So one of the huge kind of subtopics of that is talking about vicarious trauma. So there's going to be a ton of really great stuff in New Orleans in February.
Awesome.
I look forward to that.
Yeah.
Me too.
I really do.
Thank
All
you
right.
so much. And
Yeah.
I can't wait to see everyone again. And just, I don't know, I feel invigorated by this conversation. So thank you.
Oh, thank you
All right.
guys. It's great to see y'all.
Much
It was
recovery.
great to see you too. Thank you all so very much. Thanks everybody for listening. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next month.
On the Bone Club.
On the flip side.